Welcome back to The Ink Sink. I am Annie.
I'm Taylor.
This is the publishing podcast for the rest of us, where we cover books and news and writing and reading, and we are so excited to bring you today our favorite news.
That's right.
Kaylee, let's move on to one thing that made me smile. This is from The Marginalian. It is a book about fictitious dishes of food. This made me so happy.
It was gorgeous. I will say that I didn't always understand her interpretation of the meals, but like her photography and like her dedication to presentation, her artistic visions for these, and like most of them were like I could 100% could get it, and like it was right there. There was some like that I was like, oh, that's interesting, but it's still gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Oh my god, her everything was so amazing. I 100% would have that as like a coffee book.
Oh, what, like,
coffee table book
it.
To like
I want it on my table.
It's
yeah,
gorgeous.
Sure. So this is a book from Dinah Freed. It's called Fictitious Dishes, an album of literature's most memorable meals.
And I love how she just stumbled into it. Like, it was like a project.
Yeah, like a photography project. And then she was like, you know what? I want to do more of this.
This is my thing. Oh, so yeah. Good.
So the author of this, Maria Popova, the author of this article, knows Dinah Freed very well. So profiling the book itself, I'm going to link to this article because it has a ton of the pictures on it. I love the Great Gatsby Feast.
Oh my god, it was so pretty.
I love just the random just... different cups of champagne, like
oh yeah, like the like different the glasses that she has. I
because
wonder
it happens at parties, like yeah. You're getting into the back of the cupboard and grabbing like the weird random orange
number glass. One teacher mug.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that, it has that in whatever like the 1920s style.
Right, right,
like,
right.
I loved it. It was so apt and it so perfect for that. Yeah,
I have to wonder, like for the photography that she does, if she hits up like local thrift shops for unique teapots and cups and glasses
cool.
And yeah. Goblets. Like I super would like have that. Like that seems like a really cool.
Yeah,
I would be curious as a follow up, like just to understand like the process and how she kind of designs the artist, like the way that she does the layouts for these.
Uh-huh. Like, if I think that'd be find, super cool. An article about her process, I will absolutely link it in the show notes, and I'll also send it to you.
It would align with our like discussion like previously when you were talking about like the process for fact checking like your artists and like the little guy that was doing his design with the cockroaches and stuff.
That was if you haven't listened to our fact checking episode, I was talking about one extremely memorable fact checking call I had to make to a guy who his art was all about cockroaches and putting them in like Hot Wheels cars. And I had to like call him to fact check some stuff from an article that was profiling his work, and he was like describing his method, and I just like I had no idea what to say, but I was absolutely fascinated. I was like, okay, thank you.
Okay, bye. But also, bye. Like, it's just, I mean, artists in general have such a unique way of, and especially stuff like this, where it's not necessarily a traditional medium,
mm-hmm.
like ways to approach their art and like how they design things and how they conceptualize and think of things that is so unique and fascinating and like deserves to have its own spotlight, because you put lots so much passion into how you develop your method.
Yeah,
and it's personal. Super cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I will, if I can find anything, I will put it in the show notes. If not, then you can just read more about it at this Marginalian article.
Yeah.
Moving on to our least favorite section, book banning updates. So this is one of those, I can't really summarize it totally, but the Publishers Weekly published a panel from small booksellers responding to book challenges and book bans. So, or as a recap, I suppose, in the past year or 2 years, many parents' rights groups and conservative and religious groups have been going after specific books in school libraries. And they have been saying these are not appropriate for children. They should not be around children. We don't want these around our children. And many of the arguments that they've been making have been very disingenuous, willfully misunderstanding some of the content, and also willfully misrepresenting some of the content. We are on the record as being extremely biased on this topic. We believe that when you start restricting knowledge without context for why you're restricting it and just saying, you know, we don't want you to think this, that's thought police, and that's not great. But also in the specific cases of the specific books that they're going after, they're aiming for things that might make someone who is not even the reader uncomfortable. It might make a parent uncomfortable to discover that their kid was reading about gay people.
The fact that it mentions homosexuality at all, like the book is about like a kid on adventures, and the fact that the kid has two dads is mentioned.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And it's genuinely, we feel, ridiculous. Again, I want to state our bias up front because we are about to go into some insanity.
I can't express enough, like, how very clearly, like, these people's prejudices are on display here. And it's such trash. And, like, people are, again, and I don't want to be, like, I don't want to give the impression in general that this is, like, oh, well, this whole state is a problem. Like, no. these issues are being fought internally in these states by people that are pushing back because it is trash. And it's many states,
yeah. So the booksellers have been kind of insulated from this because stores are allowed to sell whatever they want. And it's tough to protest that without, you know, being very, very weird, I would say. You're not going to picket a bookstore for a whole
time. Oh, no, I mean, they can, but then
they can, and they have. But so booksellers are a little bit insulated from this. So they were talking about how supporting their communities, supporting their local libraries, supporting their schools is very important to them. And I found that very heartening. So I wanted to kind of start us off with that. So I'll be linking that in the show notes, and you can see specifically what some of these booksellers are doing. Separately, this comes to us from the Bismarck Tribune.
Read this one, by the way, so I can't help you at all.
Oh, okay. Sorry. So the state of North Dakota is planning to pass some quite vague laws with lots of concerning language. They're meant to ban specifically depictions of sex in books in the state. So North Dakota is basically saying we're not allowing any depictions of sex at any schools in the state, which I'm not sure if you know this, but national education standards require that students in 12th grade receive comprehensive sex education, usually from a book. So I'm not sure how they plan to square that circle. This is not law yet, or it wasn't as of the time that I got this story, but they are advancing this law that would say that there are no depictions of sex allowed anywhere. And they don't specify what types of educational material might be
exempted.
Yes. And that was very annoying and it's just so vague. It was like, I don't know if this ever actually happened. It might have been an urban legend, but it was one that, like, we always kind of talked about in middle school, that, like, one time some state legislature was trying to outlaw bestiality, but they didn't realize that humans are also part of the animal kingdom, so that they had accidentally outlawed all sex overall. I don't know if that actually happened or if it was just an urban legend, but I always think about that when I see things like this. It's like, your definition.
Behold a chicken.
Yes, right. Exactly. Yes.
Sorry, that is an anecdote from classical. We don't have time to from antique. From antiquity. However, if you want to genuinely just quote unquote Google behold a chicken, you'll probably get to the content of this anecdote for the context.
But in Wyoming, separately from, this comes from the Wyoming Public Media, Wyoming lawmakers are actually pushing back. So I'm going to read you this paragraph from the Wyoming Public Media. In early February, Wyoming lawmakers rejected two bills designed to keep materials deemed obscene out of school library. No, I was right. Yeah. Wyoming lawmakers are pushing back. They have rejected two bills that were designed to keep deemed obscene materials out of schools and libraries. The Senate File 177 would have opened up librarians and teachers to criminal penalties, and House Bill 87 would have done the same, as well as changed the definition of child pornography to include cartoons and drawings. So Wyoming is actually pushing back.
Okay, so I'm sorry, they have another bill in the works right now trying to figure out another way to come at this.
So this article is citing lawmakers in Idaho and Montana who are trying to push criminal charges against
libraries.
So that's the situation. I'll edit that into something coherent eventually.
No, that's fair. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Meanwhile,
there's a lot going on.
The Illinois governor did stand up for books. Do you want to tell us about this one, Kaylee?
I thought this was super cool. Like, I mean, just becoming a haven, genuinely, like, basically putting the state up as a haven state for books, and or standing against this particular, like,
stupid shit.
Yeah, I mean, it is really stupid shit. I'm gonna go on record. It's this whole conversation, the fact that we have to have this conversation as much as it is we do, like, is stupid. And it's not like we're going over the old stuff again. Like, this is just, it's driven by constantly new material. Me going, ah, that should be our sound effect for this, like,
topic.
So this is an article from Book Riot. It's a newsletter. And it's by Kelly Jensen. And basically, she explained how in February, the Illinois governor, Pritzker, J.B. Pritzker. What a name. I just also really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Felt very much like an old-timey name.
Yes, yes. That dude stood on a box with, like, a starched collar gestured strongly at people.
Absolutely. Sorry, like, had no trouble believing that. But yeah, so Pritzker basically gave his State of the State address, and
he's the governor
of Illinois. Exactly. Yeah. So according to Jensen, this is the first time a governor in the country has actually directly spoken about the censorship.
Censorship
has spoken. Wow. We couldn't get there together. I'm so upset at us.
We would do really good in the jungle, where there are no words. Just walking.
Yep.
Places to get water. I don't know. Go ahead.
So, okay, let's try this again. So, the first time
I'm leaving all of that in.
Oh, good. Excellent. The first time a governor in the country has directly spoken about the wave of censorship, book banning, and harassment being seen by schools and libraries. While some legislators in other arenas have addressed the topic, so Janie Raskin, a congressional representative from Maryland, for example, it continues to be a topic that not enough of those who have the power to address it, I added to address it, are using to discuss. Meanwhile, over a dozen bills have been proposed across the country that would remove queer books from libraries and schools and or actively prosecute professionals who have that material in their collections. So Pritzker basically, again, like I kind of came in swinging at this one and like started with my intro on this, is that Pritzker has set up the state to be a sanctuary. So support, like the state is going to be supporting public education and not allowing, or at least not supporting, this trend of book banning is in as comfortable and widespread a nature as we're seeing across the country, as people are just pushing forward for no reason.
Shout out to J.B. Pritzker.
Like, first off, great name. Second off, go team, go you.
Get your starched collar.
Doing it.
I haven't looked at a picture of him, but in my head he has a starched collar.
I have to. I'll look it up right now.
Thank you. Moving on, our favorite... No, our least favorite criminal, the spine collector.
Our infamous
criminal, the spine collector, is avoiding prison, but he will face about $80,000 in fines, and he is being deported.
I would say it's not necessarily, I guess, fines, but it's to cover the legal fees. Yeah. So I appreciate that. Like, it does seem like it's just genuinely, like, because there was no technical damage. It is just in pursuing this disruption to their business.
Yeah. So the FBI kind of landed where we had initially landed, which is, you know, you go, buddy. Like, what a crime. Like, oh my goodness. So the spine collector, for those who haven't listened to our show, is a man we now know. His name is Filippo Bernardini, who was using fishing techniques, fishing with a PH, and it wasn't necessarily hacking, but he was getting into places he should not have been by using some pretty sophisticated social
engineering. Entering, if not breaking.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. To get access to unpublished book manuscripts. And when we first heard about this, we were kind of on like his side. Because again, it's a victimless crime. And that's kind of where the FBI has landed. He wasn't selling them. He wasn't taking money from anyone. But he did kind of turn a corner as, like, you know, people started closing in. He got very, very belligerent with a lot of people. When the pandemic started, you know, more than one literary columnist was like, I'm going to solve the spine collector case, and was able to actually reach out to him, even though they didn't know who he was, and he was being really mean to them. And then he was also being super mean to some interns at some publishing company. So we kind of turned on him. We're like, you know, you don't have to be a dick about it.
You were a lot cooler in our heads, spine collector.
And now you're being mean. So basically, it did kind of turn into a more or less victimless crime because, again, no money changed hands. He was just taking these manuscripts. He says it was just because he loves books. With how big this whole thing got, any explanation he was going to give was going to be disappointing. So that one felt disappointing to me, obviously, but...
It feels a little like maybe not the full story, honestly. Like, at this point, it feels like he was just sticking it to the man also, probably.
Yeah, he was kind of not living up to the potential that he saw for himself, is what he had kind of implied in interviews. So the FBI is going to let him go, and he's going to be forced to pay $80,000 to cover all of the expenses from the trial, and he will be deported from the U.S. My guess is they're probably not going to let him back in at any point, but this just says he's going to be deported. I still wish, you know, obviously every time we talk about this, we're like, I wish that he was cooler because he's not. He seems like just such a...
Yep. Yeah, like just again, the way that he chose to respond to people, like trying to figure out, like it's people that were genuinely like being impacted by the things that he was doing.
Yeah. Like, these people were getting in trouble for giving him manuscripts accidentally.
So the fact that they had to start, like, being more aware of everything, and they were doing more corporate trainings on all of these tactics that he was using, and these people were, like, paying attention, and then he was like, well, and then responded very meanly and cursed them out. Like, that's just, you know what? Like, just walk away at some point instead. But
yeah, you don't have to be a dick. You want to read a book? Don't be a dick. Moving on, ChatGPT is still taking the world by storm. Freelance writers across the world are lamenting the fact that a lot of content mills, which was a source of a lot of freelance writing revenue, are switching over to ChatGPT instead of hiring freelance writers. Some other smaller sites are choosing to use ChatGPT for drafting and outlining instead of paying the freelance writers more to do that extra work. So a lot of work has been kind of falling to the wayside, and a lot of people in publishing are worried that we're going to be seeing generic books, basically, moving forward. And that's a concern.
So, and my sigh wasn't for this specific concern. It was for the fact that this is going to be our newest, like, 10-year-long topic, probably. Yeah. Just because it's just, there's so much happening. And there are so many, like, this is why it's a good thing. This is why it's a bad thing. And it's, I'm sorry. That sigh wasn't deserved.
No, you're fine.
But
I feel like we're going to have to get, like, a little intro music for
another one. Section, like, we were talking about, 100%.
For those who don't know about ChatGPT, it's a generative language model AI where it takes, you know, scraped text from the internet and just predicts a bunch of text moving forward. So if you ask it a question, you give it a natural language prompt, it will respond with a natural language answer, sometimes paragraphs long, sometimes pages long, depending on what you ask for. And it can, you know, create some believably linguistically rhythmic, I guess, stuff that doesn't make it accurate, that doesn't make it, you know, good. It just makes it generic, I suppose. So Countercraft, which is a Substack that we quote often on the show because I absolutely love this man's writing, I'm going to go ahead and read several paragraphs from Countercraft talking about it. They say, even the number of books published each year, themselves the lucky few who make it through the gauntlet of agents and editors and sales departments, far exceeds the number of books people want to read. Publishing is filled with flops and failures, and few writers can survive on book sales alone. And that's not even taking into account the world of self-publishing, which has its merits, yet is already filled with an ocean of crappy work, scams, and plagiarism. The world doesn't need more generic writing. We already have more writing, including more good writing, than we can handle. As much as people love to rail against quote-unquote gatekeepers, something has to pare down the oceans of work out there. Right now, there are a series of bottlenecks that winnow work until it gets into the hand of readers. And almost all of those gates are kept by people who are already overworked and underpaid. What happens when these numbers grow exponentially? What happens when the already unmanageable river becomes a torrent?
I think that there's another article later just discussing about voice and authenticity, and this was in the news specifically related to how the news is reaching out to different generations. That actually comes back to this and applies here as well, which is your personality, your voice, your brand. And I think that in general, it's going to be an issue, and the impact of AI writing in general is that it is going to end up being very general, very bland, very much like middle of the road, and you're not going to be able to establish any particular like brand with it because it is an amalgamation of everything that is legally or illegally obtained. You know, even setting aside the fact that there are questions around that, like the legality and how you're developing your AI's like algorithm, like to generate the content, like was all of your material legally sourced? Can you prove that? How are you proving that? That's the interesting thing, like the things that like Chuck Tingle and T. Kingfisher, who's Ursula Vernon, their writing is like some of my favorite writing because they're personally invested and developed a voice. There are specific things that I go to them for. I don't go to them for the same things, obviously.
Yeah.
So I get the fact that, you know, as a writer, you need money. As a freelancer, you need money. But, like, it's this whole conversation is just very concerning to me that, you know, people are like, oh, I wrote 90% of my book with this AI algorithm. And, you know, it just could be difficult for readers later to actually find something that will actually help them with whatever they're wanting to find. I don't know. It's just something to keep an eye out for. Like, there are good reasons to have AI, but then there are certain things that you need to go into it conscientiously about. I totally understand the concern that authors have. I embrace it, and I think that the discussion needs to keep going and that we need to find a way to answer it. Because again, like, it's not that your voice isn't worthwhile, but how do you hear it? And how do readers find it in the noise? It's so fair. Like, I get it. I hope we continue to find ways to work through this.
Yeah, the AI debate has been really interesting, honestly, and very enlightening for a lot of people who I think don't quite understand what generative language models are. Adam Conover. Did you ever watch Adam Ruins Everything?
Yeah.
So Adam Conover is doing a new series on YouTube where he's like breaking down complicated topics. He did AI relatively recently. I'll link that in the show notes. And his takeaway was really good. I think a lot of these articles, like, kind of talking about AI and what it's going to do to the industry, they don't have a takeaway, really. They don't have like a, here's what we know, and here's what we don't know, and here's what we think's going to happen. It's always like, AI! But Adam Conover, I think, did a really, really good... Excuse me, I just burped. He did a really, really good breakdown of the AI situation and why people are kind of going crazy over it and what actually is happening. So I appreciated that. And again, I'll link that in the show notes. And he kind of ends it on a hopeful note, as he always does, which is another thing that I appreciate about Adam Conover. But one of the things that he did in his breakdown was he showed how just factually wrong, and maybe, like, this is my bias as a fact checker or as a former fact checker, like, if something is factually wrong, then it's not worth anything.
We were talking about this, I think, last episode, maybe, about how, like, people were using, like, AIs were generating false sources for academic papers. And, like, what?
So, if, like, it's not worth anything. Like,
it's negative dollars. Yeah. It's worth negative dollars. It's costing you money because somebody has to go in and find those sources and pull them out and then find the content in the article that references those sources and then pull that out. And, like, what?
It was just, it's so dumb. And again, maybe I'm biased because apparently not a lot of other people feel that way. So no, they're just like throwing shit in.
No, but we just talked about, like, that's a problem. Yeah. You have to spend money to fix that.
I agree.
You already, like, this is you to major publishing companies, already don't want to spend money on editors today when your primary source of content is a real person that, for the most part, is going to probably choose not to insert random nonsense into the work because they want to keep their integrity and their reputation and build up on it and get paid. It's so baffling to me that this isn't a bigger concern, because you already don't want to spend this money, and it's a worthwhile area to spend money on because, again, speaking of trust, this is how you develop trust. Yes. It's like not publishing bullshit. Anyway, like, I don't...
Crazy.
How is this...
And again, like, we're obviously very biased. I used to be a fact checker, so I feel very strongly about these things. Kaylee also feels very strongly.
I was never a fact checker. I did my own fact checking in college, I guess. And I mean, I'm looking, I don't know. It's just.
It's a lot. It's ridiculous.
It doesn't make sense to me.
It is.
It doesn't make sense. This is like that time I was like looking at a commercial with my grandmother, and it was like a paper towel commercial, and like something spilled. And they're like, no, the laptop's going to be ruined. And I was like, just pick up. It's a laptop. You just pick it up. And my grandmother looks at me very seriously and says, Kaylee, not everyone is as smart as you. And I'm like, to pick up a laptop? Like, why is this, like, revolution? This shouldn't be revolutionary thought. Kaylee, I'm so confused.
Kaylee, I need you to calm your tits.
No, my tits are very agitated.
And stop touching the laptops. Kaylee?
I'm going to pull out these bombs right now.
Stop picking up things that were meant to be portable, okay? I'm only going to tell you once.
But, like, the idea that that's a revolutionary, like, the fact that this doesn't feel like it should be confusing or, like, a revolutionary thought. Like, I don't feel like I'm really smart. I don't feel like that.
In fairness, she might have been joking. Your grandma was very funny.
Okay. You're not. not wrong. My grandma's a fucking firecracker. I miss her so much. She was the best.
She's lovely. Anyway, before we start besmirching anyone, the specifically paper towel company and their acting choices, I guess, was very confusing.
It's going to be ruined. Like it was like the Home Alone movie, basically, in this commercial. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Moving on, Kaylee, I sent you an article from the Wall Street Journal about Aussie media, and I put a lot of exclamation points in it because I have been following the story for a while. So I sent you the original story from Ben Smith from the New York Times about Aussie media and Goldman Sachs. Shit has hit the fan at Aussie media.
I want to, can we add, see if we can find like a free sound of somebody clinking like a tin cup over bars.
Yes! They're going to jail.
That can be our sound effect for this anytime we talk about the spine collector. Yeah, which, yep, to be fair, that one would be like a key turning, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. Speaking of.
Or he's being let out of jail. He's avoiding prison.
Yeah, yeah.
So Aussie Media is a fraudulent media company that was most likely a front for money laundering.
The whole shakedown of how, like, the Aussie, like, thing went down.
So ridiculous.
Like, from start to finish, like, they're just like, our numbers are these. They're amazing. Like, are they? And they're like, yeah, just trust me. It's fine.
Yeah.
You just don't see it. It's fine. You can't see where we're getting our numbers from.
Yeah. So this is a media company that was, I believe, targeting Gen X. Again, these poor Gen Xers.
Gen X and millennials.
Leave us alone.
Yeah. It was
100%. Gen X and millennials, yeah. And so they're like, oh, we've got this slant on media and we're going to like take the world by storm. And one of my favorite quotes, I think from the original New York Times article, is the author being like, at a certain point, I just had to look at the sniff test. No one has ever sent me an article from Aussie media, nor have I ever seen one referenced anywhere, ever. He's like, this might be something weird. So it turns out that the people at the top were just inventing over a million, I think, subscribers. They just invented them. Their real subscriber list was something in the couple hundred thousand, which is not bad.
No. To be fair, also, it wasn't even just like a million. It was like 20 million.
Yeah, right.
Like,
sorry.
They weren't even going. They were like, you know what? Go big if you're going to go at all. If you're going to lie big.
Yeah.
Basically.
So, recently, a former executive pled guilty to fraud. And so the former CEO of Aussie Media was arrested. And that's the article from the Wall Street Journal. Basically, the Aussie executives are headed to prison. Like, the evidence is there. It's proven. They were lying. And it's kind of just the latest in a line of scams. We've seen the Theranos scam, and we saw the Anna Delvey scam. And this is kind of just one more, but it hit kind of Wall Street, where it was more vulnerable, saying, you know, oh, we're looking at millennials and Gen X, you know, these hot...
Speaking of building trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So it was one of those stories that I had been following for a while. But I just get really excited about true crime. So I was... I'm not excited that these people are going to prison, but also they're fraudsters and they should be punished.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
And they're taking attention and money, like investment dollars, away from actual sources that needed them and could have used them. And
yeah.
People were harmed. I'm not going to say probably harmed. People were harmed by this.
Yeah. Basically, if you are inventing 20 million people out of your hat, something's gone horribly wrong. You need to stop.
Like, the fact that they were still in the country to arrest does kind of speak to me that they weren't necessarily like expected. It was just like it snowballed probably, and like they weren't necessarily going into this like trying to commit crimes, but also you know, at a certain point you gotta stop.
Thank you so much for listening. You can find our link tree wherever you found this podcast.
You have a fresh new way to support us. You can donate or subscribe through our new Ko-fi, where you can buy us a coffee. We had to look that up several times to make sure we were pronouncing it correctly, but
it's really not intuitive.
It is not. No,
it's ko-fi.com and then /InkSync podcast, but You don't have to remember that. It's on our link tree, which is wherever you found this podcast.
You can just use the tip jar. It goes there.
Yes. Anything you want to do. You can see on our Ko-fi page that we do have costs for the podcast, about $40 a year. And you can help us cover those costs, or you can just buy us a coffee because you like us and I like us and we like coffee and that's cool.
We do, in fact, like coffee very much.
We'll see you next time.